This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Linda Mapes, a Seattle Times reporter who specializes in coverage of regional environmental issues in Native American tribes. Linda has won national and regional awards for her coverage of science and the environment and is the author of Washington, the Spirit of the Land, and also Breaking Ground, the Lower Elwha Klallam Tribe, and the Unearthing of Siwit's End Village. Linda Mapes is here today to tell us about ecological restoration following removal of the Elwha dams and what it means for the Elwha ecosystem and local communities in Washington State's Olympic Peninsula. Linda recently authored a special report for the Times about this topic titled Elwha, the Grand Experiment to Tear Down Two Dams and Return an Olympic Wilderness to Its Former Glory. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Good morning, Diane.
Before we start speaking about the Elwha restoration, would you like to describe how you did your research for your article on the Elwha?
Well, this project was a real pleasure because the Elwha Valley itself is such a jewel. It's a place you can go back to your whole lifetime and never get tired of. And if any listeners out there haven't been, you really should go. Now is a wonderful time with the fall color. It's just exquisite. And I spent most of two summers and two springs and two falls out there with a photographer from the Seattle Times, Steve Ringman, who was my partner on this project. And we basically haunted that valley. We went back and back and back to follow a team, an interagency team of scientists who were doing baseline research in the Elwha. They wanted to understand deeply and factually what the Elwha is like today so that they could set a baseline of data to understand how it's going to change over time. And we went along with them over two field seasons to get to know this place intimately.
What is the significance of the Elwha dam removal and ecosystem restoration?
It's important to understand what a gigantic reset button this is for our region. Nothing like this has ever been done anywhere in the world. The scale of this restoration effort for salmon is truly unique. There are other restoration projects in our country that are bigger, such as the Florida Everglades, but not for salmon. For salmon, this is number one in the world. The size of Glynn's Canyon Dam is something to really try to picture in your mind. 210 feet tall, that's 21 stories of concrete. And Elwha Dam had stood in that river since 1910. So two big, big dams, bigger than have ever been taken out before for salmon restoration. And it's not only about fish. Once these dams come out, you're going to see an entire watershed get a second chance.
What was the area like before the dams were built?
These dams were built back in 1910, starting with Elwha Dam and Glynn's Canyon in 1926. These were hydropower dams. They provided some of the first industrial-scale electric power supply for the Olympic Peninsula, which was a remote place, an undeveloped place. And early entrepreneurs, such as Thomas Aldwell, a Canadian, who wanted to seek their fortune, went to Port Angeles, arriving at a place that had a deep water port, an Elwha River full of salmon, giant forests, all these natural resources that he wanted to convert to an industrial economy. Of course, the native people, the Lower Elwha Klallam people, had already been living there since time immemorial and had based a rich, rich culture on the natural economy of the place. Thomas Aldwell was the first to show up and industrialize it. And these dams were absolutely key to that plan because they provided the electric power that drove the pulp mills that would create the jobs, the money, the industry in the Olympic Peninsula for generations to come.
What were the fish runs like before the dams were built?
Truly spectacular. I mean, it's interesting to read the notes of the early explorers that came into the Straits of Juan de Fuca who would weigh anchor and trade with native people. And one of the things they traded for was salmon. And they talk about the fish that some of the tribe members would bring to them to sell. And indeed, they talk about 100-pound fish. These are Elwha Fall Chinook, and believe it or not, genetic descendants of those early fish are still in the system today. I mean, if you go to Elwha Dam today, 5 miles from the river mouth, there's a pool at the foot of the dam, and those big fish still come back every single fall. And it wasn't just the Fall Chinook. Back in those early days, you had all five runs of Pacific salmon, Ulacan, which is another name for smelt, all manner of other fish runs, such as rainbow trout, really, it was a spectacular living ecosystem.
How much did the ecosystem change when the dams were built?
You know, it's useful to think about this as a process. It disrupted not only the migration of the fish, but the process of nature from the headwaters all the way to the sea. Rivers are living systems, and they include not only the beings that live in them, but also the physical processes. And here I'm talking about the transport of gravel and sediment from the high mountains all the way to the sea. That's a critical natural process that helps build and maintain the natural structure of the river, which is ever-changing and varied, and also the transport of big, big wood, fallen trees down from the forests. That's a natural process that was disrupted with the putting in of the dams, because suddenly that wood and that gravel and that sediment couldn't travel from the high country all the way down to the salt water, just as the fish could not travel up into the ecosystem and their offspring could not migrate out. And so the way to think about this is a watershed, an entire watershed, some 350 miles, that was basically put on hold when you put the stop button, the hold button, on its natural processes, the beautiful motion of both material and living beings up and down this watery corridor from the high country to the low. Those dams were utterly disruptive of those processes. And as they come out, which is a 3-year process, we're going to see basically a restart, a rebooting of an entire complex ecosystem. And that's going to include the food chain and the transport of material from the high country to the low and the migration of these beautiful animals. And not only the fish, by the way, but mammals that have forever traveled their migratory pathways to feed on salmon carcasses and all the other fishes and beings in that river. They're going to start coming back into the corridor of the Elwha River once there's something to eat again.
When the dams were initially installed, what were the implications for the lower Elwha Kallen tribe?
Well, they were disastrous. I mean, the tribe had built an absolutely rich culture on the natural economy of this area, and that included the fish, first and foremost, as a keystone species to the food chain, feeding all the other animals that they also depended on. And so for the tribe, once those dams went in, that diminished the fish runs. It didn't kill them outright. It was more a kind of botched hanging, a very slow decline. And the elders, the stories today tell us, understood exactly what was happening and how disastrous this would be for their people. They knew that over time the fish runs would decline. And you have to understand as well that it wasn't only the fish, it was also the shellfish in the estuary at the Elwha River, which were also destroyed because of filling of the tidelands and also the deprivation of the fine sediments trapped behind the dams that used to nourish the beaches that provided for the shellfish that their people also gathered. So the salmon, the shellfish, those gradually disappeared. And at the same time, the natural economy that sustained the Elwha Kallen people for so many generations was greatly diminished. And it wasn't just the food, it was also the connection to place based on a richness of a food source from a living ecosystem. When you break that connection between people and the landscape and the food, something profound happens. When you go to a place that's always sustained you and suddenly it can't anymore, there's a kind of sadness that happens and a disruption of a spiritual connection to a place as well as the food supply.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes, author of the report, Elwha, The Grand Experiment to Tear Down Two Dams and Return an Olympic Wilderness to Its Former Glory. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What led to the decision to remove the Elwha dams?
This is a really, to me, exciting story about what people can do if they just never give up. It started with the tribe, who back in 1986 recognized that there was a relicensing procedure that had come due. The lower dam, Elwha Dam, had actually never been licensed because it was built before the licensing requirements were on the books. Glynne's Canyon Dam, the upper dam, was due for relicensing. And under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, that meant suddenly these dams, which had built without any fish passage, were going to come into modern environmental review. Now, remember, these dams back then were owned by a private industry. This is a pulp mill that still operates today at the foot of the Elwha River, actually a little to the east at the foot of the Eddis Hook. They didn't want to own a dam. They didn't want to operate a dam. They just wanted to run their plant. And so as the tribe and soon enough environmental groups began to raise the issue of relicensing, to the owners of this industry, they were just as happy to unplug themselves from those dams as long as they could continue to have power. And so a deal was eventually hammered out under which, by an act of Congress, believe it or not, the industry was made whole with a commitment to forever have low-cost power from the Bonneville power grid. And the tribe and environmentalists and ultimately all of us were made whole by the taking out of the dams under the Restoration Act such that this watershed that had been sacrificed for power production for 100 years could be restored to be a natural place once again. So it was an act of Congress that was passed in 1991, the Elwha Restoration Act, under which these dams were removed. The industry was made whole with the replacement of power from the Bonneville power grid. And the city of Port Angeles was made all sorts of promises and commitments to maintain its water quality by the construction of a brand new water plant, which was, by the way, one of the single most expensive pieces of this $325 million undertaking.
Well, you've alluded to this, but what is the overall goal of dam removal?
The goal of dam removal is to restore the Elwha watershed. First and foremost, the fisheries on which so many people for so many years have depended, not only tribal members, but sport fishers and others who enjoy a vibrant living ecosystem. So it's restoration of the fish runs, but also restoration of the entire watershed. Part of what's going to happen as the dams come down is going to be an absolutely unprecedented revegetation. Remember, there are some 1,000 acres of bottomlands that are going to be exposed once those dams come out and the reservoirs drain. Once those reservoirs drain, what you see are these very, very fine sediments and all sorts of gray, lifeless material, some 24 million cubic yards of sediment that was trapped behind the dams. And there's not much living there. Not only that, but in some areas, this material is, it's at least 150 feet from the nearest forest. And so the seed rain that would naturally replenish that territory with the plant material that's falling out of the forest, it's a little too far from these baking, dry sediment banks right next to the river. And so there's going to be an active revegetation. For some 3-5 years now, volunteers and National Park Service personnel have been actually gathering by hand the seeds of native plants from the Elwha ecosystem, stockpiling them and growing them in a greenhouse out there near Squim. And they have been growing and growing and growing hundreds of thousands of plants, all kinds of plants, grasses, woody plants, shrubs, trees, all from native seeds, all from native plants from the Elwha Valley so that they can begin to plant them, actually starting right now, on what are going to be these terraces of material once the water drops. A lot of this replanting can only happen as these new banks of the river stabilize. And right now, with the dams still coming down, it's too unstable, too changing a landscape to do much. Mostly what we have to do now is just wait and let the river do the work. But as those terraces consolidate and stabilize, they will be revegetated. Now remember, this is an experiment. Nobody's ever tried to do anything like this before, and you can't add compost, you can't irrigate. The sizes of everything that you're dealing with here in area are just too big for that kind of hand nurturing that we would do in our gardens. And the soils that they're planting in aren't really soils. I mean, these are anoxic sediments that have not had organic material in them for 100 years. So it's going to be very tough to get things growing there. Not only that, but remember, you're going to have elk browsing on the new sprouts. And so they're going to have to figure out how to deal with predation and how to deal with these very austere, xeric, dry, baking sun environments as they try to raise new plants out there. But I'll say this, I've been out on those sediment terraces. And you know what? There's stuff growing out there already. Grasses, little fine patches of algae and green material. I'm amazed at how much is already growing out there. And we all know this. We live in the Northwest. Stuff grows on the roof of our cars if we park them long enough without moving them. So I don't doubt for a moment that life will take hold once again.
Would you comment also on efforts to aid salmon recovery in the Elwha?
You know, nothing's ever simple, right? And so it goes with salmon recovery. You'd think that all you need to do is take out these two massive dams and the salmon will saunter back and recolonize this watershed. And indeed, there's no doubt that's the case. We've seen it elsewhere. For instance, when Mount St. Helens blew, the Tootle River was so stopped up with sediment that it disrupted shipping in the Columbia River. So here's the Elwha River. You take out these two chunks of concrete and the salmon will come back and recolonize the river. Some 70 miles of habitat will be available to those fish. And so what's with the hatchery, everyone asks. And it's a very good question and one that we're going to be having to hash out as a community over the years to come. A very expensive $22 million hatchery was built for the Lower Elwha Klallam tribe as part of this restoration effort because their hatchery was basically made inoperable by the dam removal project. So here comes a new hatchery, and that's a real head-scratcher for a lot of people. This is supposed to be a native fish, wild fish recovery, so what's with the hatchery? And I put that question to some of the federal scientists who are in charge of this effort. What I heard back from them is, good question, and we want to know too. There's actually been an unusual unanimity of opposition to using out-of-basin, that is to say, not native steelhead in a portion of the salmon recovery effort at the Elwha. This is going to be stocking of Chambers Creek steelhead in the Elwha River. And the idea there is to try to jumpstart, quote unquote, a fishery in the river for the tribe. Very, very controversial because no one in the scientific community wants to see an introduction of non-native steelhead that can compete or even worse, bring disease to the very fragile remnants of the wild runs. Another piece of the hatchery that's controversial is using it to, quote unquote, jumpstart and support recolonization of the river with stocked fish that, while native to the Elwha, that is to say they're not out of basin at least, could compete with these very fragile wild runs. And, you know, hatcheries, I'm told by the scientists who are in charge of all this, are being used in this effort, not only to try to provide a fishery for the tribe with the Chambers Creek fish, but also to be a fail-safe, a safe harbor for the wild runs that are so fragile at this point. Most of them are on the endangered species list. The concern is that as all this sediment rinses down in the river when the dams come out, that it could actually kill off the very fish that you're trying to preserve and restore. So by holding on to a gene bank, if you will, and restocking with some of those fish, you'll basically hold harmless and safe the very fish that you're trying to protect. This is all very controversial. Hatcheries are something that we've used in our state for more than 100 years, and they are one of the elements that are harming wild fish. We all know this. And so where the balance will be struck is the central question here. I mean, there's a lot of impatience to have a fishery back in that river. If people were willing to wait 20 years, you wouldn't need a hatchery. However, a lot of people aren't willing to wait 20 years. The tribe wants to be able to fish within 5 years. There's a total moratorium on any fishing by anyone for 5 years once the dams are out. The tribe would like to be able to catch some fish at that time, and other people want to be able to catch some fish at least within 20 years. How long would natural recolonization take? We don't know, and some people don't want to wait to find out. There is, however, a very active community of native fish supporters who have actually filed suit to try to block the stocking of the non-native steelhead and also require that very firm goals and management direction be put into this hatchery plan such that you couldn't just have it be a permanent piece of the Elwha ecosystem, that at a certain point when certain recovery targets were met, the thing is unplugged. We've never been good at that. It's always hard to walk away from a hatchery once one is built. You've spent tens of millions of dollars on this brand new shiny plant. Nobody believes anyone's ever going to want to unplug it.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Seattle Times reporter Linda Mates, author of the report, Elwha, The Grand Experiment to Tear Down Two Dams and Return an Olympic Wilderness to Its Former Glory. What will constitute success in terms of the restoration projects? How is the success of restoration being evaluated?
I think one of the things that's exciting to me as an observer of this is how richly the idea of success is being understood. This isn't just a fish story. This is really being looked at holistically. This is a landscape scale, watershed scale restoration project. That's one of the things that makes it so unique. We've seen lots and lots, and really never enough, of restoration efforts in the Northwest over the last 10, 15 years, especially in our region since the listing of Puget Sound Chinook more than a decade ago now. There's so many creeks and streams and bays and estuaries and forests that citizens and local governments, as well as state and federal government, are working to restore. This is different. I mean, here we're talking about a place that, for one thing, just really hasn't been wrecked. I mean, one of the things that makes this one of the best chances for restoration anywhere is the fact that this is happening mostly within the Olympic National Park. You have to remember that the dams only affect a small piece of this area that's been developed, the lower river. The middle river and the upper river, much of it has never been developed in any way whatsoever, and it's permanently protected. More than 80% of the area that we're talking about is within the Olympic National Park. What that means is the only thing really missing here is the fish and the restoration of these natural processes, that is to say, the sediment and its transport, the food chain, all of those natural processes will start up again once these dams are out. And I think that what's so exciting is to think about what it really means that you'll have fish coming from the marine ecosystem, bringing the nutrients in their bodies all the way up into the upper reaches of the river, and then you'll have animals come down and feed on those carcasses, drag them back into the forests and feed the trees, feed the land, feed some 30, 40, 50 different species of animals that depend on those marine-derived nutrients. They feed a terrestrial ecosystem. So success means that you restart all of those natural processes such that the entire watershed, from the trees to the soils, to the birds, to the mammals, to the insects in the benthos of the Elwha River itself, all those organisms are going to have a new chance to live in a restored ecosystem that includes a functioning food chain fed by these marine-derived nutrients and a healthy structure fed by big wood coming down from the forests and sediment and cobble. And you'll see also the movement of the river restored. Remember, it's constrained now in part because of these dams, and even water temperatures are going to change. Dams raise the temperature of the water, and that's not healthy for fish or other creatures that live there. And all of these are measures of success. The functioning of the food chain, the restoration of the natural movement and form of the river. And I think that that's what makes this so exciting and something that's going to be watched around the world. There are risks. There are big questions. For instance, the sediment, when you're dealing with such a large volume of sediment, there's never been an effort to manage such a large amount of sediment in a dam removal project. And it's not easy. I mean, the reason this takes so long is because if you were to just take out those dams, as they did on the Condit Dam in the White Salmon River. They just blew it out and let the reservoir drain. They said it was going to take 6 hours. It took about two. It was quite a sight to see. On the Elwha, it's going to take 3 years, and only about half of the year will be devoted to actually taking out the dams. The rest of the time, the river will be allowed to kind of catch up, if you will, to let the river do the work of sluicing out all this material. Because if you just blew out the dams on the Elwha, number one, they're so big and so tall, and number two, there's so much sediment, you could risk all sorts of damage and flooding. And secondly, the river would just slice like a knife through butter that material, whoosh, which would leave these very tall, unconsolidated, potentially even dangerous cliffs of material behind, some 70-foot high cliffs of sediment. So how do you avoid that? Well, you could dredge it. But that would be terribly expensive, very slow, very polluting, very noisy. So that was evaluated during the EIS, actually dredging all that material, trucking it on out of there, but that was rejected. Instead, the decision was made to let the river do the work. And you do that by slowly taking out the dams. With rivers, gradient is everything. As you drop the gradient by taking out the dams, the river picks up speed and power, and it chews away at that sediment, and it swishes back and forth. Picture yourself, for instance, using a garden hose to move soil off a driveway. Same idea, back and forth, swish it away little by little. So that's how they're going to, they hope, manage all that sediment. Now remember, nothing like this has ever been done before, and we'll see what really happens, but that's the idea.
What are the implications of Elwha removal for removal of dams other places?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. There has been a long and very energetic discussion in our region about the four Lower Snake River dams. I've been covering it since I've been a reporter in this region, and the frustration on the part of advocates of removing those four dams as well is that you have these dams that really they were built quite recently. Lower Granite, the inlandmost up there on the Snake River, was closed in 1972. So, I mean, these are not the pyramids of Giza. These are relatively recent structures. And the frustration on the part of the advocates of taking them out is that they're fish killers and they just don't generate that much electricity or economic activity, much advantage. And so to them, there's really no difference between those dams and these other dams that we've taken out, and we ought to just do the same math, so to speak, politically and economically, and take them out. Now, on the other hand, it has to be said, this is an order of magnitude of difference. I mean, the three dams that are coming out now together generate a lot less electricity than even the smallest of the four Lower Snake River dams. And so while you can criticize how much power they make a lot more power than the dams that we've already decided to take out. The other thing they provide is a transportation corridor all the way to Lewiston, Idaho. And that navigation corridor, you can say that you don't think it does enough and there isn't enough use of it. Nonetheless, it does exist. And so if you take it away, you have to ask and answer the question of how would you replace it. That's been a discussion that's, I think, going to get a whole new life now that this decision has been made to take out Elwha, Glines Canyon, and Condit. And here's why. I think one of the most important things the dam removal that we've undertaken does is it breaks a notion, an old notion, that once you build these things, you can never take them down, that they're permanent, they're monuments. I think what this does is challenge that and say, you know what? We've made decisions rationally and sensibly in other places for sensible reasons. Maybe we ought to do that other places too. Maybe we shouldn't. But as a society, we've proven that we can do the analysis and make a decision, and that these dams in and of themselves are not timeless monuments that should never be reconsidered once they've been built.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would leave two messages. One, that this is an incredibly exciting and hopeful time in the Northwest. Here you have the three largest dam removal projects ever in the world underway in our backyard, Elwha, Glines Canyon, and Condit Dam. Wow, right here in Washington. And so there's an incredible amount of hope in that. What I see there is a society that can look at the need for change and recognize that there are all kinds of definitions for wealth. 100 years ago, it was all about creating an industrial kind of wealth and using our natural resources to create jobs and electricity. And now, 100 years later, we look around and we have more need for wild ecosystems and natural ecosystems than we do for the kilowatts those various dams were creating. It's not hard for us to replace the small amount of power they generated. It's very hard for us to find the kind of wild, robust, healthy ecosystems that those dams destroyed. And so we're making a choice to bring back the richness of that natural economy. And I think that's very exciting. And I think that the other message I would leave with listeners is to get involved. Pay attention, watch what happens, find ways to volunteer and participate, learn about these natural systems and how they work, and look forward to watching their restoration and also being a part of it.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Linda.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Seattle Times reporter Linda Mates, author of the report, Elwha, The Grand Experiment to Tear Down Two Dams and Return an Olympic Wilderness to Its Former Glory. For more information, check on the web at seattletimes.com/Elwha. Again, that's seattletimes.com/ELWHA. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.